our Bible reading, John chapter 21, and I'm going to read the first 14 verses. John chapter 21, verses 1 to 14. Afterwards, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Galilee. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, also known as Didymus, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, two other disciples were together. "I'm going out fishing," Simon Peter told them. And they said, "We'll go with you." So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. He called out to them, "Friends, haven't you any fish?" "No," they answered. He said, "Throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some." When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, "It is the Lord." As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and jumped into the water. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 meters. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have caught." So Simon Peter climbed back into the boat and dragged the net ashore. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dare ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. All four Gospels record the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Mark's is the shortest account, and I think there's good reason to believe that the end of the original Gospel has somehow been lost. There are a number of alternative endings that, generally speaking, couldn't have been written by Mark himself. Bible scholars still debate all this, but from where we stand today, we don't learn anything much from Mark about what happened after Jesus' appearance to the women at the empty tomb. Matthew doesn't give us much more. Simply, Jesus' appearance to the disciples on a mountain in Galilee, and his last words about making disciples, words that we call the Great Commission. Although, having said that, Matthew does add the intriguing detail that some of those present doubted. Matthew 28:17. Again, Bible scholars have played around with this, but I think the straightforward sense is that given that resurrections just don't happen, and yet Jesus was plainly physically present, they just found it too much to comprehend. Wouldn't you and I be a bit like that? Don't you think? Maybe we've got so used to the idea of Jesus rising from the dead as Christians 2,000 years on that the teaching from the rest of the New Testament about us being raised from the dead too one day, that we find it difficult to put ourselves in the place of those early disciples for whom resurrection was a real prospect. Don't get me wrong, it was a real prospect. That was the prevailing belief among the Jews, especially the Pharisees. But only for Israel. And only for everyone all at the same time. Jesus being raised from the dead as an individual was definitely not part of the normal expectation. And I think we can assume that all those early Christians, Paul included, would have struggled to make sense of it all. So, says Matthew, some doubted. And we see something like that in the other two Gospels too. Both Luke and John say much more about Jesus after his resurrection, and both accounts are full of fascinating and challenging details. In Luke, for example, we find the story of the two disciples walking out to Emmaus. I've already alluded to that. And Jesus' encounter with them. How they didn't recognize this one with whom they'd spent the past 3 years, and how it was only as he broke bread in their home that they recognized him, and then he vanished. Incidentally, I'm not sure, as I said earlier, I'm not of a sacramentalist frame of mind, but I think, as I say, that Luke is saying something very important for us even today, as we break bread together, as we broke bread together, as we share communion together. Do we discern not only the body of his people with whom we share bread and wine, but also in some supernatural way, a discernment of his presence with us among his people, his body? Just one of the fascinating questions that these passages at the end of the Gospels throw up for us. Luke and John tell different stories about Jesus' appearances, but both have things in common. I've already mentioned the fact that there was a sense of non-recognition and even disbelief. Thomas, in particular, in John 20, and the comment in chapter 21 about them not being quite sure whether it was Jesus or not. At least that's how I read it. He was the same person, but somehow he was different. What someone has called transphysicality. There's that new word that Phil mentioned. The same, but transformed into something better, if you like. What is also common to Luke and John is the sense that although Jesus was very physical, he goes to some lengths to try to persuade the disciples that he wasn't simply a ghost, an apparition, simply by inviting their touch and sharing food with them, for example. But there are a number of incidental details that confirm his physicality too, even though he was able to appear and disappear at will. And it's that aspect of it all that I find the most intriguing, I must admit. But think about that situation in Luke 24. In verse 30 it says, when he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then he vanished. But they were still left with pieces of broken bread. You ever notice that? Can a ghost break a loaf and leave it in pieces? Can a physical person just vanish? And I find that kind of detail far more persuasive than some of the other, perhaps more obvious proofs, so to speak, of his physicality. I think I should say at this point that for those first disciples, the concept of resurrection had to be physical. There's so much skepticism, even among Bible scholars today, about this, and there is a whole fashion for denying that the resurrected Jesus had a physical constitution. And I'm not going to bore you with lots of ideas that seem to have influenced the thinking of so many well-educated Christians. But I think the predominant theory is that the first century church somehow, because of their experience, and it was a real experience of the living Lord Jesus, with whom they encountered in their worship and miracle working, and many other ways, they developed a sort of mythology, a physical resurrection that found its way back into the Gospels as they were written. And admittedly, they were written many years after the events to which they relate. So there was a sort of writing back into the Gospels, a made-up explanation for how they had been able to experience conversion and the kinds of spiritual experiences they were having. I think that's nonsense. Some have suggested, although this idea isn't quite so common now, the idea of what has been called cognitive dissonance. In other words, the early Christians had a profound religious experience that slowly grew into a way of speaking about bodily resurrection as a way of getting their minds around it all. And if you want to delve more into this, I can't recommend too strongly a book by Tom Wright, N.T. Wright, The Resurrection of the Son of God. That's where that word comes from, transphysicality. He actually made up that word because he couldn't find it in a dictionary. It's a very long but well worth effort, the book, I mean. But in any case, as Tom Wright insists, everybody in the first century would understand the term resurrection to mean bodily rising again from death. Not resuscitation or some sort of spooky apparition, but real physical restoration after death of the same body that had died. Even those that didn't believe in resurrection understood the word in that way. The fact that they denied resurrection was because they just didn't see how it could be possible. The Sadducees, for example, whom we encounter in the Gospels, trying to trick Jesus into making a mistake. You know the story about the woman who was married off to seven brothers in turn, as each one died, and about whose wife she would be in the resurrection. See, they believed in resurrection, but all together. It's in all three of the Synoptic Gospels. So it must have been important to the Gospel writers, that particular story. And in Acts 23, verse 8, too, where Paul deliberately plays off the Sadducees, who rejected the idea of resurrection, with the Pharisees, who believed that one day all Israel would be raised from the dead. The point is that even those who denied resurrection understood the word to mean a physical coming back to life from death of the body that had died. That's the significance of the empty tomb on Easter morning. And that was true even of pagan Greeks well before the time of Jesus. They didn't believe resurrection was possible, but that's the way they understood the word. And resurrection isn't possible, is it? That's what makes it a miracle. Even the infamous ex-Bishop of Durham a few years ago, David Jenkins, made that very point. And I'm not sure whether he was much misunderstood or what he really meant, but I think he said that. And as we read through the New Testament, I think we have to be aware that if Jesus had not been raised bodily from the dead, whatever else happened to the first century Christians just couldn't be accounted for, especially the fact that they were prepared to die for believing it. We find that the fact that as they perceived it, of Jesus' bodily resurrection underpinned everything they experienced and wrote about. But let's go back to John 21. Seems reasonably clear that John ended his original gospel at chapter 20. I think the whole structure of the gospel bears that out. So chapter 21 is a kind of postscript or epilogue. An idea that appeals to me is that we see a seven-day structure, and there's a seven sign and seven-day structure in John, from the first chapter to chapter 19, the old creation in 6 days plus a day of rest, if you like. So in chapter 20, we begin the new creation with an eighth day. This is a new start, and Jesus represents what Paul in 1 Corinthians 15:20 refers to as the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. And in verse 23, he says that we who belong to Christ, that's us folks, will also be made alive. Each in turn, Christ the first fruits, then when he comes, those who belong to him. This is new creation stuff. And we are beginning to touch on a vast, vast topic of what we will be when we are raised from the dead. What heaven will be like. What happens between our death and resurrection. Whether heaven will be as physical as our resurrection bodies. Where it will be. On earth or somewhere out there in the wider universe. All sorts of questions, which we cannot even begin to address here this morning, and which we'll spend a lifetime in trying to figure out anyway. A whole fascinating array of exploration of what the Bible teaches. I do think that much of this has often been avoided, mainly because the church seems to have bought into what some writers call Christo-Platonism. Or Platonic Christianity. In other words, the belief that resurrection and the new creation cannot be physical, but must have a spiritual consistency. They say the spiritual is much more important than the physical. That's what the Platonists said. But that's not the way the New Testament writers conceived of it all. And neither, I believe, should we. The church, generally speaking, has lost out on so much at what should constitute our Christian hope, because many just cannot believe in the kind of physical life after, well, life after death. That's the way Tom Wright puts it. What I think John is doing in chapter 21 is giving us a taste of the wonder of the new creation, creation day 8, if you will. The overlap of the old creation and the new, which is where we find ourselves in our own time, between the resurrection and the second coming of Jesus, when he will finally arrive and set everything to rights. But if chapter 21 was a deliberate afterthought by John, why did he add it to an already complete gospel? And I think there are two possible main reasons. Firstly, the rehabilitation of Peter, who denied Jesus. And secondly, something about the longevity of John, the beloved disciple and writer of the gospel. And if you read to any extent about these passages, you will find that every word in that last sentence I just said is challenged by someone or other. The beloved disciple, the writer of the gospel, they're challenged, believe it or not. But that's where I stand, and I think the idea that John, the brother of James, who was martyred very early on, and was both the writer and was known as the beloved disciple, makes the best sense of what we find in the New Testament. But I want to leave aside those aspects of the chapter, and in the remaining time, have a brief look at the verses we read together. And perhaps a bit controversially, I want to home in on something I've already hinted at. And that is that although Jesus is portrayed as being the same person in the same body as before his crucifixion and resurrection, there was something strangely different about him in these post-resurrection stories. And I particularly want us to think about that because of what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 15, where he quite clearly teaches that we shall have bodies like Jesus' body when we are raised from the dead. I've already referred to verse 23 of 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul writes that those who belong to Christ will be made alive. But in verse 35, he asks the question, with what kind of body will they come? And he spends quite a few verses explaining that there will be differences between the bodies we now have and the bodies we will have then. But remember, in his mind, and therefore in ours, it is a physical, material body that we will be given when Jesus comes back. We haven't got time to read the whole passage, but that's 1 Corinthians 15. But I suggest that you do read it sometimes, perhaps after lunch today, before you drift off into your Sunday afternoon nap, if you're anything like me. Just one comment, though. Some have got stuck with the idea that Paul seems to be talking about a non-material existence. I've already said that. Because he writes about spiritual bodies, as though our resurrection bodies will consist of non-material spirit. Verse 44, 1 Corinthians 15. And the NIV says, it is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. And that might give the impression that Paul is contrasting our present bodies as physical with our resurrection non-physical or supernatural bodies, although that would be a misnomer because a body has to have substance. Indeed, that's exactly how the Living Bible translates the words natural and supernatural respectively. But that's not the way Paul uses the words, which are translated natural and spiritual in the NIV and in many other versions too. Elsewhere in 1 Corinthians, in chapters 2, 13 and 14, for example, Paul uses these same words with respect to different kinds of people in the Corinthian church. The natural people were those motivated by worldly things, and they were not open to the things of the world to come. Fleshly or worldly Christians. The word he uses there is the Greek word from which we derive our word soul or mind or psyche. In fact, that's the Greek word, psyche or psuche. So we could translate it soulish, or as Watchman Nee translates it, soulical. It's the only place I've ever seen that word. The Spiritual Man, it's a great book. I don't know whether you've come across it. In other words, Paul is contrasting those who are not spiritual with those who are. And he uses the same word for spiritual there as he does in chapter 15, to refer to the spiritual body which we shall receive at our resurrection. So it's nothing to do with non-material resurrection bodies. That couldn't be true of living very much material people in the church. But with resurrection bodies which have been transformed and energized by the Spirit of God. And you find this to be true wherever Paul and other New Testament writers use those two words. In Jude 19, for example, a totally different writer, the same words are used in this sentence. He says, "These who follow mere natural instincts and do not have the Spirit." The same two words are in that sentence. Paul believed that our resurrection bodies would be the same as Jesus' resurrection bodies, solid, physical, but nonetheless transformed. Improved, if you will. I hope it will be improved anyway. How then will our improved resurrection bodies be different from the bodies we now have? Verse 42 says that our bodies will be raised imperishable. Of course, all these references are 1 Corinthians 15. We will be raised imperishable. Death has been defeated. And like Jesus, we can never die again. He says too that whereas our bodies are sown or buried, if you like, in disbelief,